Hello everybody and welcome today with a very, very special guest joining us for the Leaders in Value Chain podcast. Delighted to have with us today Joe Foster. Quick introduction, Joe, for those of you who don't know him yet well, but I can tell you he has a remarkable story. He's one of the two co-founders of Reebok back in 1958, together with his late brother Jeff, really, and following a long family heritage all the way back, if I have my data correctly, Joe, from the 1895, where Joe's grandfather pioneered the spiked running shoe and famously made shoes for the world's best athletes as early as the 20th century with the 1904 and 1908 Olympics. Of course, subsequently, Reebok has followed the family tradition. Reebok shoes were worn by athletes that won Olympic, Commonwealth and European medals and world record-breaking performances. So, Joe, it's a delight. It's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Radu. It's a pleasure. Absolutely. And yes, you were correct. Your numbers were right there. That's fine.
And there's many stories about, and I've been reading a lot. I've also, for everybody watching us, whether you're on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on YouTube, Joe also wrote a book documenting the full details of the story, which is a remarkable story of how Reebok was built, how the company was built. And I have a couple of questions because, I want to start very pointed. And what struck me was back in the days when you and your brother were building the company, there was a period, Joe, where you went from, you were just starting, right? It was something like a 9 million revenue. And within the span of 4 years, you went to 900 million, right? Which, is remarkable to say the least. So I wanted to start by asking you, what really were the key points, inflection points that really triggered that explosion back then?
Well, you've just jumped forward about 20 years from when we started. We had a great story before, but
I'll get back to that.
Yes. Absolutely. I spent a long time trying to get into America. I got into America as a running company. We're a running shoe company. And the reason we got into America is that in Runner's World, which was a magazine in those days, big magazine, gave us 5-star ratings for 3 of our shoes. And that really gave us credentials. We got into my world's credentials. 2 years into developing in America, and we had grown to a $9 million running company. And our guy down in Los Angeles, Arnold Martinez, his wife is going to these classes, coming back and with her friends, and they're all full of it. They're all, oh, this is great. And Arnold said, whoa, Frankie, what are you doing? And Frankie said, we're doing aerobics. And of course, nobody had heard of aerobics. So I said, okay, Frankie, what is aerobics? He said, well, we're exercising to music. Great. It is fantastic. So I said, can I come down to your next class and see what you're doing? So yes, that's what happened. Down to the next class. And there's the instructor in a pair of sneakers. Half the class, about 30 in the class, half of them in sneakers, the other half barefoot, no sneakers. And it occurred to Arnold, why don't we make a shoe specifically for aerobics? So he got the red-eye flight from Los Angeles up to Boston, went to see Paul Feyerman, and so excited with this story. Ah, and Paul said, Arnold, slow down. We're a running company. Why do we want to start making dancing shoes for girls? Ah, so Arnold was really disappointed. But what happened is Paul said, well, Keep looking at it, and if it seems to be growing and doing something, we'll look at it again. Arnold wasn't satisfied, so he went round to the back door. Again, we were only a small $9 million company. We went round to our product manager, Steve Liggett. He did a better job with Steve.
Yeah,
he got Steve to make him 200 pairs of samples. When he got the samples, took them down to LA, gave them to the instructors and to some of the leading girls who were down there competing. And it took off. Absolutely. The girls loved the shoes. They were made in glove leather, nice cushion sole. They were made on a woman's last, just in women's sizes. Brilliant. Lovely. We had a problem. They were made in glove leather. And it was a little too thin. It was only 1 millimeter thick. And when you took the surface off so you could put the glue on, it went down to a 0.7 of a millimeter. So if you can imagine a shoe, 0.7 of a millimeter, after about 4 weeks, they were just breaking apart. Fortunately, we're in America, we're in Los Angeles, the girls didn't care. They just loved them so much they went out and bought another pair. It took us a little while to get that straight, and we started to use more like garment leather instead of glove leather. And then, going nicely, Jane Fonda went out, she bought a pair of these shoes, and she used them in her exercise videos. At that point, we just exploded. The demand was incredible. Our biggest problem was trying to meet the demand. And for 4 years, it was a chase. It was really a hard chase to get that, to meet that demand. Fortunately for us, during that period, Nike hit a wall. Mm. They had too much inventory, and they had to pull out of about 4 factories in Korea just when we needed them. Just when we needed them. So in we went, and we managed to get the product we needed in order for us to scale up, because we just pivoted. Now we're a small running company, and we pivoted to becoming a woman's company.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, we're a woman's company, and we went up to 900 million in 4 years.
That's incredible. So it's a combination of Jane Fonda and aerobics, but really a good timing, a good sales rep that spotted a good opportunity. I think there was a story around that. And there's a reason why I wanted to start with this part of the story. And the reason, Joe, is that a lot of time, actually most times, and especially in the day and age that we live in, we see the overnight success. We actually think that it happens overnight. We just take it for granted that it happens overnight, but it never really happens overnight. So now back to the first 20 years, right? So because that's why there's always this moment of boom, and I think probably in today's world it's a bit faster, or it can be faster or longer. In your world, it took 20 years. Yeah, I mean, it was 20 years of grinding for you and your brother to get to that moment in which in 4 years all of a sudden, you know, it 100 times the revenue. So yes, now back to the roots with that learning that, well, all good things take time, and overnight success take 20 years. So tell us a little bit how it began now, Joel.
Oh, indeed, yes. We were an overnight success in 20 years.
Exactly. And I know that when you started, so a little bit of the origin story now, when you started with your brother, there was a bit of a family dispute almost, right? Your father wasn't that happy. You had to do quite a few things by yourselves. You had to resign from the family business. Tell us a little bit, because there's some spicy details in there that I'd love the audience to know.
Well, let me begin with my grandfather. In 1895, he invented the spike track shoe. You said pioneered it. And he develops his business, really good business. 1904, he had 3 world records. 1908, he had 2 gold medals. In the 20s, that was his heyday. That was his belly pock. And, Chariots of Fire, he supplied the athletes in Chariots of Fire. We do have a letterhead that says he supplied all the athletes in the 1920 Antwerp Olympic Games. So that's what he developed a great company. He died in 1933, though. And I wasn't born until 1935, but I was born on his birthday.
Oh, wow. Talk about,
my grandmother insisted I brought my name with me. So I was named after grandfather, Joseph William. So that's why I'm Joe, after my grandfather. 4 years after I was born, World War II. Everything stopped. Nobody wanted running shoes in those days. It was army boots. And so for 6 years, we had no lights. It was bombs being dropped on Manchester. And so at the age of 10, the schools opened, because we had no schools either. So we got the schooling at 10. And I went to college eventually. At 17, I joined the family company, J.W. Foster. I probably wasn't interested one little bit in the company. It was more or less, well, okay, we're doing this. But, you know, girls, at that stage, girls were more interesting than making shoes. But at the age of 18, I had to go do national service. Because just after the war, all men had to do 2 years national service. And so I went to national service. And my brother went almost at the same time. We came back. And we came back to a failing company, because when you're away, your attitudes change, you get different discipline, You've got to look after yourself. So it's self-sufficiency. And when we came back, I guess we were different people and we looked at the business and it was failing. My father and uncle just didn't speak. In fact, they fought more than they spoke to each other. And Jeff and myself on occasions had to pull them apart. So you can imagine what was happening to the company. It was going down. And by then, Adidas had come into the UK and Adidas owned the football market. They just owned it. That was it. And we tried to tell my father, and I remember saying to him, Dad, look, we've got to change. We've got to do something. And all he could say to me was, Joe, when I'm gone and your uncle's gone, this company will be yours. You can do what you like with it. And I said, Dad, number one, we don't want you to go. We're not looking forward to that. But this company will be gone long before you, because everything changes. Why don't we get together and make some changes, do something? He didn't want to know. Just didn't want to know. Whether having gone through two world wars, I don't know. Maybe he'd lost that fight to want to do something. So Jeff and I, we decided we'd go to college, went to college, to night school, and that was a big move for us because not only did we learn a bit more about making shoes, because we knew how to make the sports shoes, but we made a lot of friends. Yeah. We made a lot of contacts, and those contacts would have become really, really important to us when, after 2 years being back at the J.B. Foster, we left and we set up Mercury Sports Footwear. That was our name, Mercury Sports Footwear. And if we wanted machines or materials, we just went to the college and they would give us all the information we needed. So we're Mercury Sports Footwear and we're doing well. Our accountant said, Joe, you're doing pretty good. After 18 months, you're doing pretty good. Yeah, why don't you? You better register that name. What? Register? What's that? We were young. We were young. We were green. He told us why. So we realized that. And he gave us a contact in Manchester, 10 miles away, to go see him and go and get your name registered. Right. To cut that a bit short, we couldn't register the name because it was already pre-registered by British Shoe Corporation, massive corporation. They offered us the name because they were not using it. They just had it registered. They offered it for £1,000. Well, £1,000 doesn't sound much today, but we just set up our whole factory for £250. The whole of the factory, we didn't have £1,000. So the agent said, well, you better find a new name. But don't bring me one name, bring me 10. What? And I'm amazed. I'm saying, look, 10. We have to be in love with this. And this is our future. But he said, well, look, every name you bring me has to go through the register. We're going to check it out. It'll take 2 weeks to do that. And if you don't get one in the first 10, you're talking half a year. You're not going to have a name. So bring me 10. Right. So we're sitting down around the table. Now let me take you back to 1943. I am 8 years old. And this is the middle of World War II. Just like COVID. Nobody's going anywhere. Nothing's happening. But we had local events. And I won a local event. A 60-yard race, I won it. Great. And I go up for my football. No, I didn't get a football. I got a dictionary. A dictionary. And I'm rather disgusted at that. However, I took my dictionary, which was a Webster's dictionary, an American dictionary. Here we are, middle of World War II, an American dictionary, Webster's. I suppose I could have played football with the dictionary, but it wouldn't have been as good as a ball, would it? You know. Anyway, the dictionary survived, and here we are now in 1960 looking for a new name. And I like the letter R. So I open the book, the R, my American book, and I'm thumbing through. Very soon, I come across R-E. In fact, R-E-E-B-O-K. Well, what's that? Well, it's South African, a small South African, Gazelle. We're a running company. Gazelle.
Yeah.
That's it. Top of the list. So we also had Falcon Sports, Cougar Sports. We had a list of birds and animals. But I took my list to the agent and I pointed it as a Reebok. That's the one we want. And he said, okay, we'll check it all out. It took about 2-3 weeks to check all the names out. And he gave me a call and said, Joe, you've got your wish. you can have Reebok. However, the registrar has a caveat, and that is if somebody starts making shoes out of Reebok skin, you can't stop them. That's it. And for that reason, he'll put you in part B of the register. 4 weeks ago, we didn't even know there was a register. So what do we care? Okay, we'll go in part B. 10 years after, the registrar came back and said, we put you in part A of the register because now everybody knows that Reebok is a sports shoe.
That's a great that's a great stamp of recognition right there.
That was it. That was the approval. Indeed.
And you see, gifts or awards, even if they come not in a round football shape, they turn out to be useful as a dictionary. Yeah, when I read the story, I was like, wow. I genuinely didn't know that Reebok is a gazelle. I mean, as I was preparing for the interview, then I read, I'm like, oh, okay, it actually stands for a gazelle. So there you go. It's a crazy story. And I know that, you know, now going a little bit forward in time again, when you left Reebok, it was, you know, I think it was the number one company in the world, and through this crazy growth building the company, for the audience, I wanted to ask you, if you were to reflect, and usually growth comes with, not usually, all the time comes with having the right people. So I'll ask you a leadership related question. In the time that you were leading together with your brother, were there certain examples, stories, right people in the right place, hiring, you know, also mistakes, also wins, that you can share with us that really made a lot of difference, a lot of impact in that crazy growth?
Right. I think the first story that really comes out of having the right people in the right place is that we had been through my father and uncle, brothers, 5 years apart, just didn't like each other, fighting. And I was going to start a company with Jeff, two of us, 50-50, just like my father and uncle, we were going to start a company. But Jeff loved the factory. He just loved the factory. He loved making shoes. Me? No. I didn't particularly like making shoes. I could make them, but, you know, repetition, making shoes on. So he said, look, Joe, I'll look after the factory. You do everything else. So everything else meant everything else. Sales, marketing, you name it, but everything else. So now we come on to, well, how do you do everything else? You can make a shoe, but you've got to sell it. So fortunately, we were very close to a lot of athletic clubs. So we went direct to athletic clubs and we created a community. So for us, people, again, it was the community. We knew all the local athletes. We knew they came to our small shop, workshop, and we developed our trade in that way. As we grew a little, of course, we had to bring people in. And yes, building a team, so important, because since we were so close to the industry, people who came to us were probably from the industry. They were athletes, they were people who wanted to become part of it. So they already had it in them that, yeah, we want to be part of Reebok. This is not just a company. This is a brand. This is something that we want to be part of. And it was sharing the successes. So we became, we had a winning culture. And that was so good for us. And the people that came in just were part of that growing culture. So that when anything, we wanted anything, it was always there and everybody grew with us. And we grew, we became the number one athletic shoe in the UK. Biggest question then is, do we increase our offering? In other words, do we try and get into tennis, into soccer? Do we try these things? The factory wasn't set up to make tennis shoes. Soccer, yes, we could have gone into football boots, but the big opposition there was Adidas. And they were so big at that, it would have cost, we didn't have the money to get into football. So what do we do? Do we increase our territory then? Go to Europe. Europe, what's that? 28 countries, 28 languages, and Adidas and Puma are both in Europe. So that's a tough one. Why don't we go to America? Well, I suggested we go to America, and the family are looking at me and saying, that costs too much. I don't do that. A bit of luck come out. The luck that I was reading a magazine called Eurosport. And in Eurosport, the British government were advertising they wanted us to export to America. They were willing to pay for a stand at the NSGA show, the National Sporting Goods of America. and that's in Chicago in February, mind you, rather cold. They want to pay for the stand, pay for our return airfare, and 50% of our hotel expenses. I could go. That was great. I could go. I went with a friend. We went, and we were making climbing boots for this guy. So he came along to sell his climbing boots, and I took my... everybody loved the shoes. They said, okay, now where do we get these from? And I'm saying, England. And most of them said, is that New England? No, not New England. The one across the water, you know, the one in Europe. Oh, right. And always it was, when you get a distributor, we'll love to try your shoes. So 1968, I'm trying to get a distributor. When did I get one? 1979.
Oh, 11 years after.
11 years. It took me 11 years to get. But when you think about it, you know, we didn't have this nice equipment here where we can talk to somebody between us, how many miles, 5,000 miles, something like that. And about the same to America, couldn't do that. What could we do? You could telephone if you were lucky to get a line, because all they had there, they didn't have satellites. We had lines under the Atlantic. And so they were always booked up. So it's difficult to get a phone call through. But if you waited, you could get one. Otherwise, you had to get on an airplane and go somewhere. So although it took 11 years, I only had 11 attempts at getting a distributor. And on six occasions, I did get a distributor, and they all failed. They all failed. But I found out why. We're trying to push onto a market which is so big, so vast, you know, compared to the UK or even compared to Singapore. I mean, you can meet everybody in Singapore probably in a certain length of time.
You do. You just go city center. Yeah.
You can't meet anybody in America apart from one or two people. So getting into the American market was the tough one. And as I say, I had six failed attempts. However, running in those days, quite a small market in terms of information. And there was one magazine, Runner's World. Runner's World, it started as a single page. And by late 1970s, the running market had just developed incredibly. Everybody was out running. There must have been 30 million Americans just wanted to put a pair of shoes on, get fit. And when that happened, people wanted to enter races, 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, even marathons. And Runner's World grew with this demand for this sort of market. Runner's World used to tell everybody where the next races were. We used to actually print the results as well. So you see your name down there. If you finish within the top 1,000 or something like that, you could even see your name. And this magazine went so well. And Bob Anderson, who was a publisher, thought that he was such a king within the running business that he could tell everybody which is the best shoes to have.
Yeah.
And on the first time he did, probably 1966, 67, it was Nike, of course. It wasn't Reebok. It was Nike. Okay. So Nike got this accolade that you're the number one shoe. But what happened? Well, Phil Knight just couldn't fulfill the orders because he's bringing the stuff in from Asia, and the factories in Asia just couldn't make the product that much. You couldn't just increase product because probably 5 million athletes wanted that shoe. How do you get that to 5 million from, you know, if he was doing 1 million a month, that would be big. He probably wasn't, 500,000 maybe. So he couldn't do it. Next year, Bob Anderson had another, he changed. And I think it was New Balance, something like that. Whoever it was, it could have been Saucony or Etonics. Same thing happened. They couldn't fulfill orders. So on the third attempt at this, he changed from telling everybody which was number one to making them star ratings. A five-star shoe, great, 4, 3, 2. And a five-star shoe, there could be at least five shoes. We got one of those. I'm talking five shoes in the trainer market because we actually got 3 5-stars. Our Aztec was a trainer. Our Midas was a racing shoe. And our Inca was a spike track shoe. That was our gold range. And our gold range all got 5 stars. That made the difference from us trying to push onto the market. All of a sudden, we had credentials. All of a sudden, everybody was reading Runner's World. Oh, I'll try a pair of Reebok. And that's what got us into the American market. And that was the start. So
it became a pull. I mean, it became a, you know, them calling you. Now, And I love this, you know, this part with Phil Knight not being able, the founder of Nike, of course, not being able to keep up with production. So let's bring for a second your brother's contribution into this. How did you guys manage to keep up? Because, and this is, you know, I told you that a lot of our audience is from a production manufacturing. Some of them are actually still, you know, producing shoes all over the world as we speak. How did you guys, tell us some stories also on how you managed to adapt your manufacturing, your factories. You also told us at some point you took over the Korean factories that Nike was no longer using. Tell us a little bit of anecdotes around that.
Well, I did realize when we were going for five stars that our factory would not cope. We wouldn't cope. We would never be able to manufacture that volume. And the other part was we couldn't meet the price because I met with Kmart. Kmart, at the 1979 NSGA show, they came up and said, we'll take 25,000 pairs. And I'm saying, okay, that's fine. And when I went to see them, because after the, he said, come along. And so they were in Detroit. So I went to Detroit, went to the head office, and they had about 100 buyers in one room, all buying different products for Kmart, which is a big retail store group. And so I went to see my man. I think he was called Biasati, Mr. Biasati. And he said, yes, we'd love 25,000 pairs of your shoes, but we need it at a better price. Fortunately, I also knew that, and I'd been talking to this South Korean company, and they were already working on it. I said, okay, that's all right. Got that handled, not a problem. So I left it at that and said, I'll get back to you, and went to see Paul Feynman, who had also come on my stand. And I said that he was running Boston Camping, and he'd been running that for 10 years with his brother and his brother-in-law. And they were just doing the same numbers every year, same numbers, same goldfish bowl, just going round and round, tents, fishing rods, you name it. And I could tell he was really, really, that was it. He was fed up with this job. And he said, Joe, you get five stars and I'll be your distributor. Well, okay, it's just another distributor, but again, I agreed if we got five stars. And this is in the February. By the time we get to August, when that's when the shoe issue came out for, of Runner's World. By the time we get there, I'd gone back to the UK and I'm phoning Paul Fireman and said, Paul, just go down to the local kiosk and see if Runner's World is out. This is the end of July. Took him an hour to come back. And when he came back, he said, Joe, that's it. You got five stars. Aztec got five stars. And they also said Inca and Midas also got five stars. So that's how we got Paul Fireman. And now we're sort of saying, okay, his first order was again 20,000 birds. And a good friend of mine was setting up the sports department group for Barter. I don't know if you know Barter. Barter are no longer in Europe. But they're very much in India and Asia, and they're very much
Yeah, in
in
Singapore for
Latin
sure as
America.
well. Yeah.
So they're setting up this. So he said, yeah, we can make 20,000 pairs. That would be easy for them. And they can also do a better price, but they couldn't do as good as South Korea. So the first 20,000 pairs they made. Unfortunately, the shoe industry in the UK, as in Europe, was just fading away. It was all of it was going to Asia. And unfortunately, Bata were a very big company. They made a lot of cheap shoes. They were on the lower end of making shoes. And also they had a rubber factory. And a new thing in the running market was using EVA, which is a sponge plastic, as against rubber. Rubber was heavy, plastic was very much light in weight. So EVA, this is what everybody was using. But Sparta had a rubber factory. They said we can make EVA, so they made their own EVA. Unfortunately, 10% of the product they made was uncured or undercured, and those 10%, when it went into shoes and people wore the shoes, it just collapsed. So instead of it being a sponge, it collapsed. So our first, like I say, our first 20,000, at least 2,000 of those were failures. Plus, they were a shoemaking company, and we had a design on our shoe which was quite aggressive, quite a strong, and they just made it. They just made everything round, so they changed the look of the shoe as well. So that was a bit of a failure. And but Paul Feynman got through this by every shoe that came back, he just exchanged it. He just exchanged it, and he never paid for those shoes. So what that did is it helped get over that first period, and it helped Paul Feynman with cash flow. Because when we came down, the next lot of shoes were going to come from Korea. And when you do this, when you're buying from Korea, you've got to have a letter of credit, which means you've got to have money in the bank. Then the bank issued a letter of credit, which means that nothing can go wrong with the payment. But unfortunately, neither Paul nor Reebok had that much money. So it was hunting around to find somebody to back the company. Luckily, Stephen Rubin was around, and he had a sourcing company, ASCO, and he came to the rescue, and he gave Paul Feynman a very small credit line, which was great. But one of the reasons I sold is that when we got into aerobics and the demand was such, the credit line wouldn't do it. So the only way we could get a good credit line, I had to make a decision. Do I allow this man to take the control, or do we just not manage to, say, scale the business? The business can, if we hadn't have coped, if we hadn't have done that with aerobics, we would have lost that traction, and possibly we wouldn't be well, no doubt we wouldn't be talking today had we not met that demand. So that's when I said, okay, I'll do that. So we let the company go in his control, and then we had a very open credit line, and that open credit line, Stephen was rather worried when in a few weeks' time it got to $20 million. And in those days, that was a lot of money. Today, it's not a great deal, but in those days, it was a great deal. But it allowed it almost took to it almost took Reebok from 0 to 1 billion in 4 years. So.
But that's, I want to double click a little bit because you, as a founder, and you and your brother at that time, to take this decision, whilst it sounds practical, pragmatic, and common sense, but it can't have been easy. Yeah. I mean, you basically, it was your baby, right? So,
Yes.
I must imagine that there were a lot of sleepless nights before you finally took the call, or?
Well, by that time, my brother had died, unfortunately. My brother died just as we got to America. So it had to be just my decision. It wasn't his decision, it was my decision. And I thought, well, either the brand has an opportunity, or the brand will probably again fail because we can't sustain the production. So I thought, well, that's okay. I'm still part of it, and I'm still the founder. And whatever they do, nobody can change the founder. So I have the satisfaction of, and I had a few arrangements as well. It wasn't just a matter of selling it. It was a matter of if we do this, everything improves. So I had an arrangement, and it was just a matter of a decision. Do we take this opportunity or not? And we took the opportunity. And yes, it did take a bit of thinking about, but when you think, well, we're not a big company, and if we don't make it, it's going to be very tough. I don't have Jeff anymore, and everything. So why don't I trust these guys, and let's see where we can go with it? So yeah, a big decision, but at the end, it was the right decision because we overtook Adidas, we overtook Nike, and we became number one in the 1980s. We were the number one sports brand globally.
And we got a question that from the audience that I think is incredibly interesting, because we're now doing this on Zoom, and
Yes.
technology has exploded. Well, in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, when you're building the company, no such thing. Yeah, I mean, telephones were probably the most advanced that you can get, and even that wasn't straightforward for much of the period. So, question for you: how did you build the culture? How do you do communication? How do you set up healthy communication lines when all of a sudden you have UK, you have US, you're expanding? Tell us a little bit about some stories around that.
Well, yes, even when I stepped back in 1990, we didn't have computers. We didn't have cell phones. So it was still a matter of travel. And the one thing about sport in those days is everything was part of a club. The athletics, they were running clubs. Football was football clubs, rugby clubs. So all these clubs, and they all had something. They all had a magazine, a running magazine, a rugby magazine. So all these magazines were read by the people who would be your customers. So advertising, it was actual paper advertising was the way to get through. As well as we used to go around to athletic meetings. We used to meet a lot of athletes. And but apart from that, no, it was just, and that's why it takes time, because we didn't have anything that reached the world. Social media, nobody had that. So, we had to do it the hard way. And Jeff, during his times, he loved running, he loved cycling, and he loved racing. In fact, that's probably what killed him. He just raced too hard. He did things. If you're in a field of 500 runners, you might be number one, but only a few can get to number one. Jeff was probably midway. He's probably somewhere like 200. He doesn't expect to any better, apart from the group that's around him. They're all of the same level. But he always wanted to beat that group. And he was physically sick at the end of every race. And I think that gave him stomach cancer, which he died of. It was a shame, but and I don't know if he'd have lived, if he hadn't have been doing that, what would the company be like? Would it, would we have taken that decision? Would we have managed to achieve number one? I don't know. It's, I'm sure it would have been different. But so given these different decisions, these tough decisions, and not all of them are really that beneficial. But for me, it was right. I can earn good money. I can be part of this, and I'll always be the founder. And that's what it is now. And that's why I wrote the book, because the book was wrong, and I wrote it as the founder. And people love the book. In fact, the universities picked up on it first, because they said, "We know this is your story, but really, there's a lot of business information in here. How you made these changes, what you did. We learned that an obstacle, a challenge, was an opportunity. 4 years into our business, we got a letter from the Adidas lawyers to say that our silhouette, two stripes and a T-bar, infringed their three stripes. And first, it's like another one. It's like somebody saying you can't use your name. You can't use your silhouette." And for probably 5 minutes, we thought, "Oh dear, what are we going to do?" And then we thought, "Just a minute, Adidas know we're here. Adidas have written a letter to us. We're obviously on their radar. Yeah, we're here. What do we do?" "Well, okay, we'll just change the silhouette." So we changed it to the Vector, which we see today. So we ended up with a better silhouette, and then in the first instance, we ended up with a better name. So we developed this mindset. Okay. Challenges, yeah, those are opportunities. And then I think in business, you've got to look at that. Look for white space where we had to do it in those early days. We had to go to cross country running, fell running. We had to take areas that Adidas either wouldn't go to or didn't even know existed. So we look for white space. So you look for that white space, and then you look for anything that comes as a challenge as an opportunity.
And I gotta ask the question, and not that you're gonna do this, right? But if you were to start a business today, right? And Julie won't let you do this, and you don't wanna do this, but I'm
I know.
just curious, right? I mean, really bringing it down to the today's moment, right? And there's it's been a whole literally whole revolution, and I mean, what we're seeing today and the speed with which everything moves is mind-boggling. But I would be curious just to get your ideas or perspective, just looking at the world through the today's lens.
Well, in today, you do have a lot of opportunities, but also a lot of opposition, a lot of challenges. I would again recognize the challenges as opportunities, but I would be absolutely tech savvy. I would know everything I could know about the technology and how I can use that in social media, because that is so important to be able to use that. I would have to use influencers, because that in, people say, "Well, we're moving away from that," or "I don't want to do that." I'm sorry. Ever since my grandfather gave his shoes to athletes and got world medals and world records and gold medals, he gave them to people who were going to win. And that was the influence. So you would need to look, how do you influence the sales? So still, and it could be through social media. Yeah, I mean, Reebok went to, they used musicians, they used Hollywood stars, not just performers, but it was again influence. So I would certainly look at all that. And whatever business I'm going into, I got to know it from A to Z. I've got to know the whole thing, everything about it. And I've got to know a little bit more. And that's the white spaces. How can I make a difference to that which I'm going into, and then focus? And the most important thing is have fun. Because if you're not having fun, it won't work. We spent 11 years trying to get to America. Was that a slog or was it fun? A lot of slog, but a lot of fun. I mean, it's so important that you're enjoying what you're doing. So that's how I would go into it. And you look around, who's the right people? Some people are very talented, but they're not entrepreneurs. They don't take a risk. And an entrepreneur takes a risk because he's an optimist. So you've got to be willing to do that. And if you do all the other things, put them together, chances are, not so certain, chances are you will make it. An entrepreneur is not assured the minute he opens a company up that he's going to be a billionaire. He's not assured of that. Got to keep focusing. And if you stay there, we have a golden nugget. Just keep going. And if you just keep going, that white space will open up in front of you. It will come. Those opportunities, they will come. But you have to be willing to keep going. Sometimes it's quick, like sometimes overnight, sometimes it takes 20 years.
Exactly. And I love the mention of the word fun, Joe. I mean, I'm personally, I'm completely with you on that one. And I mean, I can't work if I'm not having fun. And I tell this to the team all the time as well, that we should have fun. I do believe that, unfortunately, in my view, a lot of companies have become this very rigid corporate, extremely serious and dull, really. Places where it almost kills the human spirit, right? Because it's like we're not meant to just be there and then, I mean, I think you can have fun and work your ass out, right? I mean, these two are not contradictory at all.
No, if you're having fun, you will work your ass off. You're
Yeah.
willing. Yes. You'll do that extra mile. You'll do it because you're having fun. If you've got to think, why should I do that? Then sorry, that's not the entrepreneur. And that doesn't really lead to success.
Yes. And I'll just end because and you were telling me before we started the show, right, that you had the conversation recently with the current CEO of Reebok. Obviously, Reebok has changed ownership under ABG now. And I just want to make that plug a little bit, right? Also on online and on air. And you told me how you felt that the brand is really just it was a it was a bit of a press down and now it's just exploding back. So just talk us through a little bit how you're seeing things developing and how you're seeing Reebok in the next couple of months and years.
Well, of course, Adidas, who bought the brand, they didn't really want the brand, but they wanted its assets. Because Reebok had a lot of agreements in America. They had a lot of the football, what's that? The NFL
NBA.
and the NBA, they were supplying them. So they had, that attracted Adidas. Adidas took the company over. They wanted to make Reebok a fitness brand, not so much. They wanted to push them into fitness because they wanted to keep team and other sporting performances. And so Reebok ticked along and went down. They were about a 4 million brand. Well, Adidas paid 3.6 billion for the brand. And by the time they were ready to sell it, it was down to 1 billion. However, ABG was Shaquille O'Neal being 15% of the company, and Jamie Salter, who was the CEO and chief shareholder, he said that every time Shaq comes to see me, the first thing he talks about is Reebok. And as he's leaving, the last thing he talks about is Reebok. So he said eventually they bought Reebok. Now it was valued about 1 billion. They paid 2.5 billion because they wanted it. This people had to put sealed envelopes in for the bid. And they put a bid in that nobody would be anywhere near, $2.5 billion. But their model is different. Their model uses licensees. So they have licensees globally. So they sold licenses. India has a 40-year license. That's a big license for a brand. So they sold that. Yeah. They sold the licenses around globally, and they probably got the $2.5 billion back in the licenses. And now they get a royalty on top of that. So what that does, it exposes the brand. It gives the brand visibility. If your brand hasn't got visibility, people don't see it. If it's not on the high street, mind you, the high street's not doing well these days, but malls are doing brilliant. But you've got to be seen. So if you're in all these outlets, you're being seen. And that already, I think I said, the reading earlier today, somebody said, no, it's valued at $10 billion. So they bought it for $2.5 billion. It's gone 4 times in 2 years. They've quadrupled the value of the brand. So it's, and now where it's going with Shaquille O'Neal and Allen Iverson, they're going to concentrate on basketball, and they're going to disrupt basketball. They really are. And that's going to be a big, big challenge for Nike in particular. It's going to be a big challenge.
I mean, and you have the best, talking about influences, yeah, a moment ago you said, what would you do? I mean, focus on influences. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal is a goddamn visible influencer in the space of basketball. He also knows a lot of people and he has a lot of friends. So again, for us and for the work that we do on a regular basis with companies, it's quite fascinating how, you know, you can take an incredible company, an incredible brand, you put the, you know, a set of people in charge, it goes one direction, it does a, you know, certain set of performance metrics, you put a different type of structure, people in charge, and all of a sudden, you know, it can explode. So
yes,
quite fascinating. Well, Joe, it's been an absolute delight having you. Thanks for sharing their many, many stories. The overnight success of I want to urge the whole audience to obviously get the book and read the full details of all, and absolutely also thank you for the overlying principles that you shared a little bit. If you were to build a company and a culture again, I love in particular, of course, because I am biased on the fun part, but you also mentioned very wisely, keep going and, you know, focus and put in the work and make sure you know everything about the white space and a little bit more.
It's been a pleasure. It really has been a real pleasure. And the book is Shoemaker, and it's available at Amazon.
Super. Many, many thanks for joining us.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.